Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1, the sound alternative. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Joining me in the studio is Alexander Martin Wisson.
Get it right for the listeners, indeed. Martin Alexander, Alexander Martin, whichever you prefer, really.
Yep. How's it going, Marty?
Oh, not too bad, yeah, for a Monday morning, and looking forward to Jeff's kisses. Oh, he's distracted, he's preoccupied distracted. At the moment. He's attending to serious business, so no kisses this morning.
Look, the funnest folk of them all, or the folkiest fun guy of them all, Mr. Jeff Bullen, the dulcet tones, always such a privilege to come on After Air on a Monday morning. He'll be back next week, but of course you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTRFM from 9 a.m. As I said, this is the Indie Media Show. If you're not aware, that's all the news and interviews from the open publishing wise of the interwebs. That's where it all started anyway, but it's all about citizen journalism, activist media, that kind of thing. A diverse show today, but an important one, Alex.
Indeed, a follow-up story today for regular listeners. They would be familiar with the story, and indeed, it's got a fair bit of mainstream media coverage. We're going to be speaking a little later on to Richard Hamilton, who is, among other things, a trade union activist involved in the National Tertiary Education Union. He's an academic. He is also what you could now describe as a long-suffering victim of the niche living residential construction company. This is, I suppose it's fair to describe it as a zombie company. There is speculation that it's technically insolvent, but it's rolling along. It's, long story short, left several hundred people throughout the Perth metropolitan area with incomplete houses, waiting for years for these new home builds to be completed. People have left homeless. People are living in camper vans. In Richard's own case, he actually had to move to Bali for a month because it was cheaper to live over there. It's a dreadful situation where these homes remain halfway complete years after a contract should have ended. State government's done nothing, essentially. And it was actually the Nationals leader, Shane Love, who spoke in Parliament last week and had some pretty strong words to say about it. And this comes amid, of course, the wider context of a whole bunch of building companies are collapsing, not just in Western Australia, mind you, but throughout the country. And it's, so it's kind of a microcosm of a much, much bigger story in terms of the huge housing crisis, throughout the country, both for renters and potential new homeowners as well. So Richard's going to share his story and give us sort of the latest updates of what's going on for customers of niche living.
Also, if you've taken a drive in the southwest of WA or even around metropolitan Perth recently, you may have noticed significant, browning of trees and the dying off of many of our woodlands and forests. Like coral reefs across the globe, the forest woodlands and coastal heath of southern Western Australia are currently undergoing a bleaching due to rapidly changing climatic conditions. Scientists had warned that this was a possibility after observing a similar event in 2011 in Western Australia's northern Jarrah Forest. This current collapse is quite widespread, and so far it stretches more than 1,000 kilometres and has destroyed an estimated 100,000 hectares of vegetation. And this is the subject of a new documentary. This has been referred to as the Brown Off. And Brown Off is a new documentary by well-known and renowned documentary filmmaker Jane Hammond. It's currently in development stages. Jane's looking to develop this documentary about this terrifying ecological collapse that we're facing here in Western Australia as the result of climate change. She's currently developing the documentary, and we'll be catching up with her a little later in the show to talk about that, talk about the film, and perhaps how you, the listener, can support her in getting her off the ground. So lots of important things to discuss on today's program, Marty.
Indeed, and maybe a few words, although I suppose probably there's not much to say about it, which is sort of the story with this much hyped so-called peace summit in Switzerland, some 90 countries represented, supposedly trying to resolve peaceful settlement of the war in Ukraine, but of course Putin not invited. But yeah, perhaps a few words about that. Putin did make an announcement. You can be sceptical about the seriousness of it in terms of a peace proposal which would leave Russia occupying about a fifth of Ukraine. But anyway, sort of interesting that I think it perhaps reflects Western imperialism's desire to end the war, at least at a theoretical level, while at the same time that they, you know, funnel arms to Ukraine to escalate the war at the same time.
Lots of reasons to keep it locked to indie media this morning, but we're going to kick off first with a track by local folk Salary. This is the track Polite Rebellion. You're on the Indie Media Show with Alex and Ray. Salary on RTR FM 92.1 with their track Polite Rebellion. And you're on the Indie Media Show with Ray and Alex.
Simsei Construction Group, Collier Homes, New Sensation Homes, Western Luxury, Flexible Homes, Inspired Homes. The list goes on. That's just a partial selection of the building companies in Western Australia that have collapsed in recent months. And I read the figure Australia-wide at some 1,200 construction companies that collapsed last financial year. So it's one element, one important element of a larger mosaic, a larger story in terms of housing crisis, the lack of social housing, the lack of rental properties, etc. And of course, it doesn't help when those construction companies are collapsing left, right and centre and leaving many thousands of people with incomplete homes and projects. And one such story is the story of Niche Living. And Niche Living is it's not insolvent, it's not bankrupt, although there is some evidence or some argument to be made that it is technically insolvent and therefore what's sometimes referred to as a zombie company. And there's many hundreds of people from Tapping to Dalkeith who've been left with their home builds incomplete. They're paying rent and mortgages on top of that. There's no resolution in sight for these people, some of them homeless, some of them living in camper vans. And one person who's wanted a home built with Niche Living is Richard Hamilton. Now, I suspect that the company didn't know who they were dealing with when they went up against Richard Hamilton, because he's a very experienced trade union activist and campaigner, and indeed he spearheaded sort of the public campaign to get Niche Living to come to the table to get these projects completed. Or barring that, the state government to step in and get these homes completed as well. So I had the opportunity to speak to Richard a little earlier this morning to see where things were up to with the campaign, and asked him to start with an explanation or a bit of an outline of his own personal circumstances.
Hi, Alex, and good morning, everybody. I signed a contract for a house in Orillia, which is in the city of Kwinana, in December 2020, in the middle of the pandemic, and I was promised on signing that completion would be within a year to 18 months, which, as I said on my previous discussion with you, I thought a bit over-optimistic. But I thought sort of 2 years would be a realistic time frame given the issues around COVID. But 2 years later, the slab hadn't even gone down. The slab went down in April 22, and they moved very quickly from slab down to what they called lockup, although it's questionable whether that meets the industry standards. And then, like so many other people who've built with Niche, everything just ground to a halt. And I made contact around that time with other people in the same situation, and a very clear pattern emerges, which is Niche rushes through the stages in order to claim progress payments, and then work stops, because the way the contracts are designed is they're front-loaded, so they make all their money in the early stages, and it then tapers off. What they do instead is they just sell more land, sell more packages. I have a modest income. I'm on my own. And as this dragged on, I struggled more and more to cope with paying rent, mortgage, expenses on two properties, because that's the other thing at the time. They didn't tell me. They told me I wouldn't be liable for things like council tax, strata fees, but all of those kicked in within about a year of signing. So I've been basically attempting to pay for two households for well over almost close to 4 years. Towards the beginning of last year, I hit a crisis. I could no longer afford to pay rent because they wanted to put my rent up again. It had gone up 33% in the course of 2 years, and it just became untenable. So on the promise they'd made me at the time, I was expecting the house would be finished sort of March, April. So I sublet a friend's property who was away at the time, and expecting by the time she got back, I would be in my house, and that didn't happen. I went through most of last year in a series of sublets and house sits, and then till the beginning of this year, I became homeless. I had nowhere to live. The house sit I was in at the time came to an end early. And if anybody's attempted to try and find short-term accommodation in Perth in the middle of summer, you'll probably know how difficult it was. We're talking sort of $200-$300 a night for Airbnb, $180 a night in a backpackers if you could even get a room. So I did the very West Australian thing and decided to temporarily relocate to Bali because it was cheaper for me to spend a month in Bali than try and find anything in Perth. I got back in February, and on my lawyer's suggestion, I had a meeting with Ronnie, who's the managing director of Niche, and we attempted to negotiate an outcome. And the outcome, they promised me a practical completion on May the 10th. Now, for those of people who don't know, practical completion means the house is basically finished, subject to minor defects, and you have an inspection and work out what the defects are, and then you move in shortly afterwards. That was in writing. Needless to say, they didn't meet that. So by May the 10th, it was nowhere near complete. In fact, it had gone backwards from December. He did provide me with temporary accommodation in the form of a derelict property in Dalkeith, which he's bought to demolish. It looks like something out of a horror movie. We negotiated that minimal rent. The house is damp. The house has got black mold everywhere. There are doors missing. There's no door on the toilet. There was trash that had been left by previous residents all over the place, which they've never cleaned up. And that was on the basis of the assumption I'd be moving out on May the 10th, but not that it would have to see me through the winter. And now winter's coming. It's becoming very unpleasant.
Horrible situation, Richard, and multiply it by several hundred. You could perhaps give me the exact figure. It's estimated somewhere between 400 and 500 people in similar situations, people living in camper vans, people's mental health, under great stress and trial. I mean, in terms of who's to blame here and how to resolve this crisis, when we've spoken to you previously, the devil's advocate argument is that, and there's perhaps some truth to it, that there was an overstimulation of the market with the, I believe it was $900 million from federal and state government subsidies at the height of COVID, building stimulus. The state government has blamed, and indeed Niche Living has blamed, supply chain problems and increasing costs in those supply chains in terms of contractors and trades and so forth. So whether or not there's merit to those arguments, we're now obviously a couple of years on from COVID, and yet here we are with these houses still incomplete. So in terms of where the blame lies, it's perhaps an academic question because it's a question of resolving this situation for people now. But where does the blame lie in terms of state governments, Niche Living itself and so forth?
As it happens, I am an academic, so I am going to approach it as sure. a philosopher. And the thing that troubles me about this whole situation is the way people talk about things like market conditions, industry conditions, supply chains, as if these are things. But they're not things. These are processes. These are decisions people make and the frameworks in which they're allowed to make these decisions. And I want to really stress that. So I'm not an economist, but it's pretty clear to me if you pump loads of money into an industry, it's going to have a boom. And if you do so at a time when there are supply chain difficulties, where there are material difficulties, this has to be managed. So I think one of the things that's clearly exposed is the failure of free market ideology, the whole idea the market will sort things out. And more broadly, one of the things I want to really stress is we need to locate this in the broader housing problem. Now, on 6PR last Friday, Gary, I think, put it very well. He said, this is not a housing crisis. This is a national emergency we're facing. And it's not just myself and the small group of Niche people. It's the people trying to find a rental. It's the people who are living in substandard rental accommodation. It's people on housing waiting lists. It's people who are desperately trying to keep a roof over their head because of the hikes in interest rates over the last few years. So it's a systemic problem. So I think questions about blame, I think we need to blame the system that's allowed that to happen. And that, in that context, a state government who were prepared to sit on their hands and just say the market's going to sort it out, and that's at state and federal level. There's a lack of thinking about how to address this other than we'll just give them more money. So there's a meeting some of the listeners may have heard about scheduled for this week between Sue Ellery, who's the Commerce Minister, who's got oversight of this issue, and the Managing Director of Niche. We don't know how that's going to go, but one of two possibilities is they're going to give them a bailout of some sort. So they're just going to pump more money into it. If that happens, I think the minimum we can require is that comes with some serious strings attached. They're not allowed to simply use the money and buy land with it or invest it. They have to actually use it to complete. But broadly, I think it poses the question about the whole nature of the housing industry in Western Australia and in Australia more generally. The whole idea that housing's become an investment rather than a human right. So questions of blame, yes, there are individual bad actors, and for reasons of defamation, I'm not going to name names, but there are some pretty shonky people out there. But there are also politicians who are cowardly, who are unwilling to take action where it's needed. And I think in our case, the government, the state government, the state Labor government, to blame.
Yeah, and it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you look at the sequence of events over the course of the last week, it was actually the Nationals opposition leader, Shane Love, who made a speech in Parliament, and he actually gave a press conference with several affected customers. Now, he had some strong words to say against niche living. One could say that he has the luxury of doing so in opposition because he doesn't have the power to do anything. But I can't help but notice in terms of the time frame here that it's then this week that Sue Ellery is... arranged a meeting with niche living. The question is, you use the phrase sit on their hands before, and it does seem the state government's very much sat on their hands. Some customers have said, well, we wish that niche living would simply go under, and there is an argument to be made that they are technically insolvent already. But that raises a question of what the state government is playing at. Are they waiting for the company to go insolvent? Why, if there is a bailout, which may be the best practical outcome for people waiting for homes to be built, why have they not announced a bailout previously? There was this $10 million loan facility for incomplete homes, but apparently it's not covered, or niche living, it doesn't have access to that loan arrangement. So that's a long-winded way of asking, why has the state government indeed sat on its hands and really not done anything practical to resolve this dreadful situation?
I had meetings towards the end of last year with Sue Ellery's secretary and then with the Building Commission, and the message I got from that very clearly was the state government are terrified about pushing builders like Niche Living into receivership. I think you've probably heard this morning Inspired Homes has just gone under. So there's been a series of collapses of building firms over the last year, 2 years, all of whom have been trading insolvent in the run-up. You don't suddenly become insolvent. In most cases, they've been insolvent for 2 or 3 years and have been doing whatever they can to trade their way out of insolvency. And once that fails, they go into insolvency. But the state government have clearly taken the position that they're going to protect the building industry at the expense of the customers. And the loan facility was too small for niche because of the scale of the problem, but it was a drop in the ocean. It allowed the government to say they were doing something without actually committing or risking very much. So they don't have the power, I believe, to force them into insolvency. There are regulatory bodies who can investigate whether or not they are trading insolvent, but they seem to, particularly ASIC, have seemed to be very reluctant to do that. So why they haven't bailed out yet, I don't know. I suspect it's partly the free market dogmatism that says the market will magically solve all this. But it's kind of odd and very depressing for me as a union activist, which I have been all of my adult life, to see a supposedly Labour government being outflanked by the Nationals on this, because, let's be honest, the Nationals and Liberals are just as much responsible for creating this situation as Labour. They've created this market lunacy for the last 20 years.
Sorry to cut in there, but Richard, but I thought we'd sort of zoom out again. Touching on what you were talking about earlier in terms of this is a systemic problem and indeed a national emergency. And indeed, even since we last spoke to you, you've spoken about Inspired Homes collapsing this morning. There's been a whole range of companies that have gone insolvent. And we're not talking about a Perth-specific problem in terms of a lack of housing. So that's sort of a much, much bigger question, perhaps beyond the purview of this interview. But what's your own take, and as a trade union activist, but also through the prism of your own individual experience, of what needs to be done here at a state and federal level in terms of dealing with this housing crisis? I mean, and specifically in terms of niche living, what is the best approach? Should it simply be taken over by the government and nationalise potentially some of these housing companies?
I think that would be the ideal solution. I think we need a public funded, publicly controlled, worker, democratically controlled housing industry. That's the sort of goal in the long term. I think one thing it has clearly shown is the market can't manage the delivery of basic necessities. In the short term, they should bail them out, but they should bail them out with very, very strongly beefed up regulations. So a kind of traditional social democratic approach would be in the short term, but for various reasons that can't be sustainable. So I think the long term, we have to start raising the question of nationalization again and not make it a dirty word and just say other countries have done it. Also, other countries, the idea that privately owned housing should be the norm. Well, lots of other very successful countries don't do that. Germany is the classic example, Austria. Public housing should no longer be something that is only for the people who are in desperate circumstances. It should be the norm. But obviously, that's a long-term wish list. In the short term, the government has to step in and say this situation isn't acceptable. If they are going to use our money, because ultimately it is our money to bail these people out, then it needs to come with some strings, quite serious strings.
Just finally, Richard, perhaps a silly question given all of the frustrations that have taken place over the course of several years, but is there any room for optimism here in terms of, Ellery, we'll await the outcome of this meeting between Niche Living and Sue Ellery, but you raised the prospect earlier of some sort of bailout. Is that potentially on the cards? And finally, a resolution to this dreadful situation?
Who knows? I mean, I am not very optimistic in Minister Ellery personally. I'm not very optimistic in the government. I suspect we'll get the usual sort of banal press statement about a productive discussion and the government making its position clear, et cetera, et cetera. So I suspect the most likely outcome is no outcome, so just platitudes. More optimistically, there may be some sort of bailout. It might not be adequate, but it might help some of us. I mean, in my own situation, I've now been promised the 29th of July for my PCI, and I've been given something of a timeline. The striking thing is, I mean, the site supervisors, the people who actually do the jobs on the ground, are actually, on the whole, pretty good. They want to do a good job. I think very few people who are working in the building industry, actually building stuff, want to do a shoddy job. And the message I keep hearing from them is, like, we're prevented by the people running this industry from everything's got to be done on the cheap, everything's going to be done quickly, with inadequate time, inadequate materials, which then ends up with defective houses. I think a better funded, publicly run housing industry would be better for the people working in it as well. It'd be safer, among other things.
Richard Hamilton there speaking to us about his trials and tribulations with Niche Living, and indeed we'll see the outcome of that meeting between the Commerce Minister Sue Ellery and Niche Living this week, if there is indeed any outcome, as this Niche Living saga continues.
You're on the Indie Media Show with Ray and Alex. Almost 11:30 with you until 12:00 when Out to Lunch comes on your radio. Going to go now to a track by Bad Dreams, one of their older tracks off their Dogs at Bay release. This is Bogan Pride. You're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. Just then we heard from Bad Dreams with Bogan Pride. Now, as I said at the top of the show, I guess for anyone who's travelled down south recently or even just driven around any of our local woodlands or forests, you probably would have noticed a lot of trees that have browned off or died off. And this is a part of an ongoing phenomenon that is closely linked to climate change and a dramatic climate changing. Someone who's very concerned by what's happening is Jane Hammond. Jane is a local producer and director who's made the two fantastic films Cry of the Forest and The Black Cockatoo Crisis. She's now turned her attention to this ecological collapse, the dying off of our forests, particularly in the southwest. And she's making a new film called Browned Off about it. It's currently in development stages. And I had the opportunity to talk to her this morning about the project. And I started just by asking about this phenomenon, why so many of our trees are dying off and so much of our forests are dying off, and what's causing it, and why, she initially became so concerned about it.
Look, when I was making an earlier film, Cry of the Forest, there was mention made in that film by one of the key scientists that we'd seen in 2011 a forest collapse, and that was part of the Northern Jarrah Forest. So that was quite a serious canopy loss that we were experiencing then, and that wasn't particularly well known about. Now, in 2022, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that the Northern Jarrah Forest was at risk of catastrophic ecological collapse due to climate change, based on that earlier 2011 collapse. So fast forward to 2024, and we are now seeing that predicted demise of our forest system. Only this time around, we've been so dry and so hot for so long that we are seeing this massive strip, it's 1,000 kilometres from Shark Bay down to Albany and Denmark, with forest loss, coastal heath loss and woodland loss, this massive browning off. And so I figured that this was something that we really needed to draw people's attention to and follow the science to see whether, you know, this is irreversible. What's causing it? How is the forest reacting? How are the heathlands reacting? And what about the biodiversity? So I'm sort of interested in examining all those reasons as well as the cause.
Yeah, and I guess talking about the cause, and obviously this film is still in development, and I imagine, you know, this is a huge part of it is finding out exactly what's going on. But I know, for myself and a lot of friends, they've sort of witnessed this, as you call it, the browning off and the death of so much of our forest, this 1,000-kilometre stretch, what's quite a remarkable amount of forest. And I guess for a lot of us, we've just assumed it's because of the drought, because we've had such a dry and long extended sort of Indian summer here. But it feels, as you're insinuating there are other issues at hand. Do you have any, findings from your early research in the previous films in terms of what is causing this and how severe the situation is?
Yeah, look, we're undergoing, climate change, basically, as everyone knows. But in the southwest, we've been particularly hard. And when I say the southwest, I mean the broader southwest, not just the Margaret River region where I'm based, but the whole of the southwest, sort of, Geraldton down and even further than that. So we're seeing this, drastic drying out of that climate, and all the ecology that relies on that water is having to cope. So it's not just a one drought, it's just again and again and again. So when we see really severe drought, and we already have a forest and other ecosystems that are under stress from clearing and fragmentation, we're mining our precious forests. We're doing, we've been mismanaging our forest lands for so long. So they're already sort of weakened, and we've got the dieback, the Phytophthora, also impacting. So we've got this sort of multitude of environmental factors that are hitting the forest, environmental and human-induced factors. And then add to that really, stinking hot, dry summer, and, the vegetation is at its wit's end. So that's what we're seeing here. Now, if the vegetation does recover, and the forest is incredibly resilient and incredibly, remarkably so. We don't even really fully understand how resilient it is. But if it recovers this time, what is the next time and the next time and the next time? We've seen between the last ecological collapse and this one, it's been a little over a decade. But what if those gaps get closer? What are we going to see, and what is the impact on our biodiversity and, human health as well, because we rely on the forest and the woodlands for mental health and for rainfall.
Certainly.
It kind of got double whammy,
Now, Jane, as you mentioned, of course, you produced and directed fantastic films in the past, including Cry of the Forest and The Black Cockatoo Crisis. And I was sort of thinking in preparation for this interview, I guess, about the historical role of documentary. And I guess both these two documentaries really seem to be, a call to arms, an attempt to mobilise the general public. I think historically, documentary, if we go back, decades and decades ago, often was more about uncovering truths for the public and to get people more informed about certain issues. I think some of the great Australian documentary makers of our time, I'm thinking of people such as John Pilger or others, really they're focused on, I guess, exposing things to the public. And unfortunately, it seems these days a lot of people are aware of issues, but they don't necessarily have the means or ability to take action or know what to do. Do you think that in terms of your documentaries that you've made and this one that you're going through development at the moment, how do you approach it? Are you trying to, I guess, empower people? Are you trying to activate people? I mean, obviously, there is this, an actual investigation in this documentary where you're trying to find out exactly what is going on and how we can potentially solve the issue. But what is your approach? And do you think it is different to historical documentaries?
Yeah, look, I'm part of a worldwide movement of social impact documentary making. So, you know, it's not just out there to entertain, oh, wow, that's fabulous. It's here's the story here in all its glory and all its beauty. The stories are told to be sort of digestible communicative. So you fall in love with the characters, you fall in love with the environment. But then what do you do? You know, the last thing I want is people to leave the cinemas or their TV screenings feeling, oh my God, it's too late, because it's not too late. Mm-hmm. So all these, the films that I make are about connecting people to the story and then getting them to move into action. And that's something that, you know, we can give them the tools afterwards. Like, if you're concerned about this, this is what you can do. And one of the best things you can do is talk to your MP. You know, I'm often told, why don't politicians watch these films? Well, sometimes they do, but I'm not interested in that end. I'm interested in grassroots end, in communities and community building and how they can influence their political leaders. So the idea is to get audiences engaged and then give them a roadmap as to what they could do together, collectively, you know, to really make a difference. And, you know, in this particular film, we're looking at not only what we're seeing in this disaster that's unfolding in front of us, but we is just unavoidable to see this, to watch the Browning. You know, it's happening across Perth as well as the southwest. But, you know, to look to the reasons why and to put pressure on our government to start to make some real changes in terms of climate action. You know, we have a federal and state government that are going, pushing the gas industry and fossil fuel industry at a time when that's so anachronistic. You know, we've had here in WA, we've had Pauline Hanson down opposing wind farms. You know, we're seeing a crazy backlash, the return of the climate wars. And until we can get our politicians to start being responsible for the people they represent and not the businesses that provide them with the political funding so that they can retain their power, until we change that system, you know, we're going to see this repetition of, sort of a crazy old-fashioned approach to our power systems. Mm. Literally, energy systems as well as our, you know, our governments that just aren't listening.
On that, Jane, your last couple of films, I guess, while they talked about the broader picture, they did in a way focus a lot on the clearing of native forests and that loss of habitat, both to the critically endangered black cockatoos, but also just the damage that's been done through clearing to our native forests. As you've very well articulated there, of course, other impacts, such as gas and coal and other, I guess, you know, the fossil fuel industries are having a huge impact on our natural environment here as well. Unfortunately, on the one hand, you know, we have got a state government that after decades and decades of grassroots campaigning has said that they are going to protect native forests in terms of no more logging or clearing of native forests. However, as you rightly said there, both state and federal governments are just absolutely going hell for leather in pushing for gas and other very disastrous fossil fuel projects. It's a bit of a harder sell in a way, isn't it, for people? It seems a lot of people are happy with, you know, the saving state forests and native forests from clearing. That's recognised as an antiquated industry for many people. However, there seems to still be such a push for you know, I guess, mining and gas and so forth. Does that affect your approach? And do you think it's a bit of a harder sell and a harder campaign? You know, we've seen how much, you know, the activists around Disrupt Burrup Hub have been targeted by the state. And just in general, you know, that sort of criminalising of climate activists here has been quite remarkable. Is it a bit of a harder struggle? And in that sense, is it a bit of a more difficult project for you?
No, I don't think it's more difficult. I think the point is that, you know, we've been sold this pup. We've been told, oh, this is our responsibility. And we don't have to worry about climate change. We're okay, you know, leave that to China, leave that to the US. So, but right now in our backyard, we are seeing and feeling the impact of climate change. So that should bring the story right home. You know, this is in real time. We are seeing the disaster unfolding, an ecological disaster unfolding in our backyards. Our beautiful Margaret River region is going brown. Our water is running out. I'm here, you know, we've had rain now, but all summer we were carting water. So people are at the forefront. They are witnessing it. We can no longer hide and bury our heads in the sand and say climate change is for someone else to solve. It's for us, and we're feeling the effects, and we are going to be one of the first places in the world that's going to see, if we don't change our ways, we're going to see the collapse, possibly, of our forest systems. And not only our forests, we're looking at woodlands, we're looking at coastal heath. What happens when we lose our coastal heath? We lose, you know, we have huge blowouts, we've got sand in our, you know, our gardens are gone, our beaches are disrupted. There's going to be real and visual and obvious signs of climate change. So let's connect those dots. The best thing we can do to protect our forests as a better management, but also to stop emissions. You know, we've got to quickly transfer to a renewable future, a future that is affordable, that will create jobs and that is positive, and away from these destructive, polluting industries like gas. Now, we don't need any more new gas, and yet we are going, you know, like nothing's happened, like it's business as usual. But, you know, just look outside. If you know, Meg O'Neill opened her front door and looked at the dead trees around us, you might sort of wake up to the fact that we can't do this anymore. So that's the kind of, that's the underlying storyline. So let's look at the science, let's look at what's happening, but let's tell the broader story of we're seeing the impacts, but we also have the power, if we collectively work together, to stop this crazy march to oblivion through carbon emissions.
Finally, Jane, the film Browned Off is currently in development stages. I imagine probably the thing you want our listeners to do the most is to get along to the Documentary Australia page and perhaps make a donation or share it or support it in some way. But yeah, how can our listeners, I guess, support you in getting this documentary off the ground if they, you know, care about this issue and want to see the film made?
Absolutely. Yeah, they can Google Documentary Australia, Browned Off. It's easier than giving you a web address. You know, make a donation to the film. I make these films basically on a shoestring, based on community input, so that it becomes, it's a people's film, these, you know, the films that I make. They can also follow us on Instagram at Browned Off Movie or on Facebook at Browned Off, and really engage with the campaign. We'll have, you know, there'll be updates coming out frequently. This will be more than a year in the making. Please join us.
That was Jane Hammond speaking to us earlier today about her upcoming film project, Browning Off, or The Brown Off. And if you want to find out more information, as Jane said there, you can just Google that and support that film project. This is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Going to go now to a track by Mathis. He's a single that came out a few years ago, Airing Out. Mathis with Airing Out on RTRFM 92.1. It's now time for a bit of Indie Media News. Children in Gaza continue to die of hunger. On Thursday, the World Health Organization confirmed that there have been 32 deaths from malnutrition, most of whom were children under five. The findings came as UNICEF said nearly 3,000 children have been cut off from treatment for moderate and severe acute malnutrition in southern Gaza, putting them at risk of death. Meanwhile, the UN reports violence against children caught up in the war last year reached extreme levels, with an 21% increase in extreme violations. The surge in violence came amid Israel's withering assault on the Gaza Strip, now in its ninth month. In Brazil, protesters took to the streets on Thursday after lawmakers advanced a bill last week that would equate all abortions with homicide if performed after the 22nd week of gestation, with punishments of up to 20 years in prison. Abortion is only legal in Brazil in cases of rape, anencephaly, or a life-threatening risk to the patient. And there's been record-breaking extreme weather reported around the world. Authorities in Athens have shut down the Acropolis and other major sites during peak hours as Greece records its earliest ever seasonal heatwave. In Puerto Rico, the mayor of San Juan declared a state of emergency as the island reported widespread power outages, leaving some 350,000 customers without electricity last Wednesday night amid soaring temperatures. Puerto Rico's power grid was taken over by the Canadian-American company Luma Energy in 2021, despite widespread public opposition. Puerto Ricans have continued to suffer persistent blackouts, yet pay some of the highest electricity rates in the U.S. And Christopher Delore, the head of Reporters Without Borders for the last 12 years, has passed away at the age of 53 from complications of brain cancer. Delore fought tirelessly to defend press freedom and persecuted journalists. And a year ago, he was quoted, and I think this is an important quote here, when asked about Evan Gershevich, Christopher Delore said, "Evan is clearly a Russian state hostage, a sort of institutional hostage. We know how Putin succeeded in the past decade. He finalized it right after the beginning of the war, how he succeeded to extinguish, to re-suppress pluralism, independent journalism, to provoke an extinction of his own country." So very much involved in covering the ongoing conflict in Russia and Ukraine. And Alex, I believe you
heard which segues very neatly with a few brief comments about the so-called peace summit in the Swiss Alpine resort town of Bergenstock. Around 100 delegates from around 100 countries in attendance. I say so-called peace summit because, frankly, it's inherently absurd to call it a peace summit when one of the parties to the conflict is neither invited nor in attendance. There was a series of motherhood statements, communique delivered at the end of the conference that was signed on by more than 80 countries, reiterating the importance of the territorial integrity of Ukraine. The UN Charter should be the basis of any peace deal, and sovereignty of all states should be respected. Vladimir Putin did, for PR reasons, put out a statement sort of ahead of the conference saying, and this is sort of the discussion or the question, is this a reasonable proposal for calling for the Ukrainian withdrawal from the four oblasts, the four provinces that Russia has annexed or is attempting to annex to become part of Russia? And that Ukraine should declare its neutrality status and make a pledge never to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So, we've spoken at length on this show about supporting the Ukrainian right of self-determination and independence. We can't be hypocrites and be selective in supporting that right. But that's perhaps needs to be, you can argue that needs to be weighed against the realpolitik principle of how this war is going to end, because there's no end in sight. It's for the Ukrainians to decide, I think it's the most important point to make, because the reality is that any kind of peace settlement may involve Kyiv ceding certain territory, or you can make the maximalist argument that, push on until victory, until Russian forces are displaced from those four oblasts. But then at what cost? How many hundreds of thousands of young Ukrainian men will die to achieve that victory? So it's,
Yeah, there's two different ways of looking at it. There's sort of moral principles involved, and then there's the realpolitik involved. And even according to the statements that came out of the summit, there's no sort of end in sight, to this conflict. I mean, one interesting side note is the countries that didn't sign up to this communique were Saudi Arabia, India, South Africa, Indonesia, United Arab Emirates, and just briefly, that sort of list of countries is significant because it shows you some of these mid-range powers associated or increasingly closely aligned with Russia and China are falling out of the Western orbit. Slowly but surely, or quite rapidly in some cases, the influence that Washington has to corral all of these countries under the same tent and sign up to these communiques is just not what it was in the 1990s. So that's one thing the West is up against, is that Russia has plenty of economic partners and supporters from India to South Africa, etc., and they will help provide a bulwark for the Russian economy and allow them to continue on with this war indefinitely.
And that's about all we have time for today on the Indie Media Show. We'll be back next week from 11 a.m. Keep it locked, though, as Rianne is coming up very shortly with Out to Lunch, all your new music needs to kickstart your week here at RTRFM. Hope you have a great week. We'll be back next week. But as we say every week, Alex,
don't hate the media.
Become the media. Here's a bit of Paige Valentine to take you to 12 o'clock.